Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is the New Books Network podcast on Russia and Eurasian Studies, and I'm speaking today with Pavel Khazanov, assistant professor of Russian at Rutgers University, where he teaches courses on Russian literature and history. Today, we are discussing Pavel's new book, The Russia That We Have Lost, Pre-Soviet Past as Anti-Soviet Discourse, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Something of noteworthy interest to me. So thank you for sharing that, Pavel. I would like to just ask, what were the things that brought you to publish this book at this time? What interest, you know, led you to publish this book here?
Sure. I would say that in general, the origin of this book is in this 1990s moment that I remember very well as a kid. I moved from Russia in 1997. And this memory of that moment that I have, going back to my childhood, of this massive and extremely well-funded valorization of the pre-Soviet past that suddenly appeared everywhere in the public sphere at that time. So, for example, like the biggest project around that I still remember TV commercials for, because they were fundraising for it, was this construction of this Cathedral of Christ the Savior, which is this absolutely enormous church in the middle of Moscow that had been knocked down in the 1930s on Stalin's orders. Although it wasn't actually particularly old to begin with, because it was only completed in the 1880s, and most Moscow-based intelligentsia figures of imperial era despised it and thought it was horrible and really ugly, and just generally represented everything that was wrong with the Russian state. So it wasn't particularly surprising that it was knocked down. But in any case, it was then reconstructed in the 1990s to great fanfare and absolutely enormous budgets and extremely fast. In a state that was otherwise in complete disarray and falling apart, you know, like this is like a really horrible, horrible era for most people who lived through it. But nevertheless, there were these massive celebrations of these returns of pre-Soviet imperial Russian heritage. And there was a certain sense, I think, for a lot of people at the time, and a lot of people since, and the people that I've talked to, people certainly of my parents' generation, that that return was somehow a foregone conclusion, that that return was somehow like a self-evident move, of a post-Soviet state. Like, of course you would, right? Like, the Soviet Soviet state was bad. We need to find the roots of something that was good. Therefore, pre-Soviet must have been better. Therefore, we're going to valorize the pre-Soviet. So, right, like, if you're looking for, like, this kind of, where, what else are you going to do? Like, what are you just going to, you're not going to sit around and start building, like, German post-war Bauhaus here, you know? Which is, incidentally, what the Soviet state actually did. So there was a general sense that that we're somehow returning from this aberration of Soviet history to the original path, which had been stunted by the by Soviet power in 1917, that somehow we can replay that original turn in one way or another, find these kind of sources, these connections, and play this game of inheritance. And I might add that this game of inheritance was not only played like on an entirely symbolic level. Like, there was like the post-Soviet Russian government, like, literally, you know, brought lawsuits like in France and Spain, like reclaiming imperial property as the successor of the Russian Empire. This is not like, so this is not merely symbolic. There was actual literal reclamations that were happening on a legal level. So my question is, well, why was it a foregone conclusion? Why did it seem so self-evident that this would legitimate everything, that this would somehow be helpful? What kind of cultural schemas did that whole process of legitimation through this valorization of the pre-Soviet past? What were these cultural ideas tapping into, right? What was the full range of ideas that these returns of the pre-Soviet past were actually legitimating, supporting, and etc.? And I think that the key term in that sense of legitimation for me was this idea of return to normalcy, whatever it is that normalcy is or normativity might be for Russia, and who gets to speak about it, and where they got their ideas of what the norm is. And once I started doing research on this question, first of all, I realized fairly quickly that the original discussions about the reconstruction of the Cathedral of Christ the Savior had already come up in the early 1960s, as surprising as that might be, among Soviet conservative cultural figures like Ilya Glazunov, who figures in the, I believe, the fourth chapter in this book. No, the second chapter, sorry. Sorry, it's been a while. Yes, the second chapter. But not only that, the general kind of argument of a return to normalcy was an argument that the whole post-Stalin Soviet like cultural establishment was in one way or another negotiating, beginning with like 1956, really. That sense that the original aberration, right, even according to Soviet power itself, had been Stalinism, right? This is the claim that the state made after Stalin died, that Stalin had been a sort of a this cult of personality. He had introduced this aberrance to the original pure Bolshevik theory and practice, and that therefore we now must return to something that preceded it, right? So obviously the state at the time said, well, we have to return to our pure Leninist roots. And the post-Stalin intellectuals were quite skeptical about that claim of return, or if not skeptical outright, then certainly skeptical enough to also suggest returns to other forms of normalcy, of pre-Soviet, what they understood as pre-Soviet kind of cultural models of normalcy. And once that discussion came up, I think that the main effect of it that interests me was the return of the idea of who exactly it is here that is the elite. How this elite, this cultural elite, should refer to itself, how it should think of itself, what name should it give itself, and vis-a-vis whom does that name and does that kind of collective act and struggle against or collaborate with, and etc. And here I think a very telling decision, and a decision that didn't seem like a decision, it really just seemed self-evident, that was made in the moment, was they called themselves the intelligentsia. And this is a very normal kind of word to take up in the Russian cultural context. Of course, you would call that, like, that's what all of the Russian cultural elites have referred to themselves as since like the mid 19th century. So how else should you do it? So there was a kind of a self-evidence to this fact, but it was a very fraught proposition to actually do that in a way that not that almost no one in the moment really fully reckoned with, which is that with the return of this term of describing oneself as a kind of heirs of the imperial intelligentsia, this return of a kind of a normative ideas about what an intelligentsia is, that it implied a return to a social imaginary, right? An imaginary that sort of how you imagine those around you, how you imagine your political community, how you imagine where you are in the pecking order vis-a-vis everyone else. But that imaginary had been formulated originally in the 19th century under very different social conditions. And in a sense, the book makes an argument about what happens when you take up this kind of retrofitted imaginary without really reckoning with what has changed between its origin point and its new iteration beginning from the 1950s. And what had really changed was this rise of essentially a modern, educated, urbanized mass polity that had been created by Soviet power willy-nilly over the course of its 40 years of modernization. And so what does it mean then that you're referring to yourself as an intelligentsia or you're invested in these ideas of the classical intelligentsia and the return to intelligentsia values? What does it mean then when suddenly your audience in the context of that conversation now numbers in the millions or in the tens of millions, thanks to TV and film and, you know, mass print and the party, which had, you know, carried out this mass literacy and education campaign that made sure that everybody went and read all of the classics willy-nilly, not particularly well, but they did, you know. So what does it mean now when you now have the kind of audience that the, you know, imperial intelligentsia could never even have imagined for itself, right? Like in the situation where like less than 10% of the Russian Empire had even been literate, never mind pay attention to them, right? So what happens then to kind of all of these fundamentally elitist kind of claims that a lot of intelligentsia discourse has always been ready to use about itself, about what culture is, about those who possess culture, those who make culture? How can you continue making those kinds of claims when your audience for those claims is no longer people you would consider your peers as, you know, fellow cultural elites, but the mass readers, the mass viewers, the modernized mass public that you might refer to kind of for shorthand as a modern middle class? Even though that's also a very complicated term to use in the Soviet context. So that's kind of where I see the project originating and then proceeding from that point to then think about, okay, so if you are bringing back this intelligentsia social imaginary, and if that's at the core of what you're bringing back when you're talking about returning to normal after Soviet power or after Stalinism, but if that's what's at the core, well, of course, it's after Stalinism, but then, you know, shortly thereafter, after Soviet power, right? So if that's what's at the core, and if there is this fundamental mismatch between the point of return and, meaning this 19th century cultural system that no longer holds true for Russia at all, and if there's a mismatch between that and the reality in which these intellectuals are acting in a mass polity that can hear them and that can identify with them and that starts to think of themselves potentially as a junior intelligentsia, as a kind of a junior elite, in a sense.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So the book tracks this discourse through cultural history and is quite rich in specific examples, starting with Pushkin all the way through modern day. From film to novels to plays to thought leaders, there are so many examples that you use to track this discourse. Did you have specific biases or specific interests or specific criterion by which you chose these examples from cultural history? How was that?
Yeah, that's always the kind of the big question of when do you stop reading? When do you stop viewing? Where do you cut off? And some things did get cut off, actually. I had an entire fairly large section on the films of Eldar Rязанов, for example, that did not end up in this book, even though they could have. I think that the motivation had been provided by a certain kind of dialectical, kind of theoretical structure that took shape when I wrote the introduction, and that essentially re-laid out the general sense of the book from where it had originally started to the draft that is actually published. So the first draft was actually a dissertation, and that first draft kind of proceeded from this normative dialectics as how we actually understand Soviet culture to be, which is like, this is the conflict between liberals and conservatives, right? This is a very typical story that we often tell about the late Soviet intelligentsia. It's a story that the intelligentsia itself tells about itself. Right? It tells the story that there were these like nativists and liberals, right? That essentially fought it out in various cultural venues and journals and in films and on television and in academia. And they essentially fought these battles. Sometimes they got quite pitched, like in the 1960s. And both sides always claimed that the state was on the other side, which is sort of hilarious. Although I do think that on par, the state was more pro-conservative than pro-liberal, but it's not to say that the conservatives always felt like that they were getting everything that they wanted. So that kind of like normative framework was a framework that originally guided my selection of like, okay, well, let's pick as many things as essentially as I can find that valorize the pre-Soviet past on the liberal side versus that valorize the pre-Soviet past on the conservative side. That was the original motivation. And then when I laid out all those things, I started noticing the ways in which there's a symbiosis between them. And the ways in which they're not arguing with each other, but actually completing each other's argument. The ways in which it's usually the liberals who start the argument on essentially culturally conservative grounds, because they're anti-Soviet grounds, because they're anti-socialist grounds. And then the conservatives essentially then come up to them and say like, okay, yeah, well, so let me take you where you don't want to go and let me finish your thought for you. And that then became this motivating structure for the book, where chapter one is this appearance of this, like that I write out, this kind of clarity, and if it's possible to articulate like the clarified discourse of the return to normalcy of the post-Stalin liberal intelligent, right? Chapter one essentially lays that out through these figures that are just extremely prominent in Russian liberal cultural history, figures like Akhmatova, like Lotman, Edelman. Edelman is actually not so much chapter one, but Lotman certainly. Or Grigory Pomerantz, whom I like very much as a late Soviet thinker. Let's start out from that position of trying to articulate what that clarified discursive logic is on their side in terms of who they are and who the subject of history is as far as they're concerned. And that subject is this liberal intelligentsia subject. And then chapter two is this conservative response of saying like, aha, well, let me show you all of the things that your new liberal intelligentsia subject has done for us. And what it has done for us is, A, it has divorced the intelligentsia from socialism. It is essentially making the argument that whatever is happening at the level of the socialist state is in fact abnormal. And what that means then, and the other thing that it's done is it is now valorizing certain modes of being refined, culturally refined, as opposed to your political commitments to, let's say, a kind of a broadly social democratic slate, which certainly, you know, a general commitment to some version of social democracy was absolutely the overwhelmingly dominant trend among the imperial cultural elites, right? And especially in the last 20 years of imperial power. But all of this kind of recycling of the intelligentsia ethos now is essentially cutting a lot of that stuff away, because it's saying that, well, that's the stuff that actually brought about Soviet power and brought about Bolshevism. So there's a great deal of skepticism with it. If not outright denial, I don't think that they would necessarily outright deny that heritage, but certainly the liberal intelligentsia figures were often quite skeptical of it. And the concern is essentially coming in and like, okay, well, let me finish that thought about your skepticism and let me just say from the start that actually, like, cultural refinement, yes, ideas of social liberation, they were always bad. You should have stopped. You should have never had them in the first place, right? And this is something you can see really prominently in a figure like Solzhenitsyn, writing in the 1960s and 70s. And this is really, I think, when Solzhenitsyn moved to the United States and the American public finally discovered Solzhenitsyn's full platform for post-Soviet Russia, there was a lot of skepticism and sudden realization of that this guy is far more right-wing than American intellectuals were willing to hear originally. But it wasn't a particular surprise for anybody else coming out of the Russian intelligentsia milieu. So the conservatives essentially pushed the argument, and but not only that, They also start making certain additions to the liberal intelligentsia argument that might then become useful for power, for in their case, late Soviet power, whom they are courting as their as a patron, from whom they want support, and later the rise of post-Soviet power. So that logic then of like the liberals starting the thought and the conservatives finishing it is the logic that drives the first four chapters. So chapter one and two are these essentially kind of mirror images in that sense. And then chapters three and four are essentially both chapters about how that general theory of what the intelligentsia is, how it then filters down through Soviet socialist mass culture institutions and then creates mass culture, creates those films watched by millions, those books read by millions, creates these really prominent Soviet cultural artifacts that you can pull over just about anyone on the street in Russia today, and you can say like, have you seen the Mikhalkov film? And they'll of course say yes. Like, it's nearly unthinkable that they wouldn't. Well, maybe the very young generation might not, but certainly any generation of my generation and certainly my parents' generation would have been unthinkable that they wouldn't have seen these things. Chapters three and four are much more motivated by that level of selection of like, well, what are these massive mainstream cultural products that are the result of this theory and this theory's meeting with Soviet cultural institutions? And finally, chapter five is the chapter of this post-Soviet synthesis, the synthesis of both conservative and liberal vectors in the creation of post-Soviet Authoritarianism, whose basic claim to power has always been a kind of omnivorousness, where it can basically churn to various groups, various interest groups in the country, and can go to both of them and say, like, see, you're getting what you want, right? Like, it can go to the liberals and say, like, see, I'm not shutting down your theaters. Well, that was true certainly before the war started. See, you can fundraise, you can have your plays, you can have your stuff, you can have all of your newspapers and your freedom of speech. Isn't that what you wanted? Like, you can totally have it, right? You can have you wanted to be able to have a capitalist culture system where you can make lots of money if you're prominent writers and filmmakers, and you can have it. There it is, right? And it can also turn to the conservatives and can offer them the same kinds of perks, and can also say, like, well, look, but I'm carrying out all the things that you guys like, which is this kind of, you know, politics of national sovereignty, right? Of this kind of, like, celebration of, like, Russian ethno-national primacy and in our triumph in the conflict against the West. It can sort of go to both sides and can give both sides some of what they want to hear, and can do so much more convincingly, much better than late Soviet power could.
Mm-hmm. So, in that sense, it has this discourse has proven to continue from the late Soviet period through the post-Soviet period up until today, really.
Yes.
And the examples that you use throughout the chapters of the book prove that. Perhaps, you know, you'd be willing to share with us how the imperial cultural heritage looks today and what direction that might be going in.
Well, today it's obviously bristling with armaments and waging an incredibly destructive, aggressive war against a neighboring state. And the actual rhetoric of that war can be copied almost verbatim from something that a young Vasily Shulgin would have been writing in 1905 or so. And this is the same Vasily Shulgin who's in my chapters two and four, who lives into a ripe old age and ends up being as kind of an informal advisor and sort of conservative guru in late Soviet culture. So the linkage between the kind of rhetoric about the Russian Empire and what the Russian state is currently carrying out is pretty clear. I think that there is a difference, possibly a kind of a cautious difference, is I don't think that the current articulations of the Russian state and its kind of valorization of the pre-Soviet past are as convincing to the liberal opposition side as they had been before, not only before the war, but I think even before 2012, really, that first big challenge to Putinism, and in many ways kind of the origin of contemporary Putinism. I think we can sort of pretty readily say that before 2012 is kind of early Putinism, and after 2012 is late Putinism, although God knows how long the late Putinism is going to last. So I don't think that the state's approach to the liberals is as convincing anymore, and I don't think that the general deployment of intelligentsia discourse is as successful anymore. I don't think it calls forth as many people who want to hear it, who want to identify themselves in that way. But I do think that at the level of the basic structure of Putinist institutions, most of the people who were there before 2012 haven't really disappeared, right? And most of the people who were called forth by that logic that I describe back then are still in power or near power. These people like Kudrin, right, who appears at the end of chapter 5, right, as one of the people who supports the construction of that monument to Stolypin, right, in Moscow. And it's like, and all these like figures that are part of the Stolypin Club, which is this kind of economic think tank, for example, right? That takes on very tellingly this name of this late imperial era prime minister as its kind of totem. So I guess I would say that at the individual and institutional level, I would say that the state is still in that paradigm of those same people, at the level of how this discourse connects to the outside of the regime and its institutions, I think that relationship is different. I don't think that relationship is as strong at all. I'm not one of these people who believes that the Putin state is like somehow like remains popular, or remains popular among the middle class or something, or the elite. Like, I think that was true for Putinism for quite some time, but I don't think that it has been true since the war started. But I would still say it is not to say that fantasies about the glorious pre-Soviet era have been dispelled. Like, it is not to say that today your average educated urbanized Russian walking past, let's say, the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, or maybe better, something less polarizing, like the Iberian Gate, for example, in Moscow. Like, I don't think that the average person walking past that construction is thinking to themselves, like, hey, that was a bad idea. Right, like, or hey, the return of these pre-Soviet symbols was a bad idea, or something, or the return of like the double-headed eagle, or something, or all of these kind of symbols of imperial state power. Like I don't think that they've been entirely discredited. Although I would say that, like, I think it is telling that one of the major symbols of protest against the war and against Putin that arose in the first months of the war was the white, blue, white flag, the flag of Russia without blood. This is kind of, it started sort of, I think, on the internet, and then appeared in protests, and then was, you know, subsequently banned and heavily policed. But I think that even that turn of redoing the flag, for example, in the public sphere, I think that also indicates a kind of distaste with reclaiming the past. And I think the war especially has made it very clear to Russian liberals that there is not necessarily a past worth salvaging, or if there is a past worth salvaging, then you have to go about much more carefully about it. In a way, actually, I think that the past that is potentially being revalorized right now is the 1990s. And I actually think that the next turn in the post-Putin epoch is going to be a new relitigation of the 1990s and what that moment had really offered. So I'd be curious to see if there's going to be like a return of 1990s architecture. That's going to be great. So,
well, the discourse certainly continues.
Yeah.
Right. And the cultural production continues as time goes on. So this is quite a fascinating subject. And I'm grateful to have learned so much from your book.
Thank you.